Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the laws that govern conduct during wartime, both for uniformed soldiers and also for civilians working in war zones under government contracts. And certainly we know that now there are a lot of them in Iraq, for example. Private contractors now outnumber American soldiers. They provide array services, including security. Recent concerns about the reckless use of deadly force have led to a fundamental question there. If a private contractor commits a crime, what law applies to their actions? We'll try to talk about that and also about the law of war as it applies to uniformed soldiers. And we have as a guest someone who is an expert in the field. His name is Gary Solis. He is 2006-2007 scholar in residence at the Library of Congress and also was recently appointed first director of West Point's Law of Armed Conflict Center. He is an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches the law of armed conflict. He's a retired U.S. Marine with 26 years of active duty, including tours of Vietnam as an armor officer. He has a law degree from University of California, Davis, as well as degrees in criminal law from George Washington University and Ph.D. in the law of war from the London School of Economics and Political Science. He taught there for 3 years, then moved to the U.S. Military Academy and retired from West Point in 2006. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief, and we ask that so that we can get as many callers in as possible and keep things moving along. But certainly, anyone who is listening to us this morning is welcome into the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line. That means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Solis, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You bet.
There are two areas here that I do want to talk about, and I want to talk about both the law as it applies to uniformed personnel, soldiers, clearly, and those people who are civilian contractors. Mm-hmm. So that's, in a sense, two separate but overlapping kind of areas. But as a way of asking an overarching question, let me ask you to speak to a question that you yourself posed in a piece that you wrote, a commentary piece that was published in the Los Angeles Times about, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or something like that, and that regards the system of military justice. And here, I think primarily here you're talking about military justice as it applies to uniformed soldiers. But here the question you ask is this: is the military justice system broken? What sort of answer do you have for that question?
My answer is that it's not. It works very, with great difficulty in a combat zone, but it is working. We had a similar problem in Vietnam. So the law of war, of course, the wonder is that it works at all. It doesn't work very well, but it does work. We convicted 95 soldiers and 27 Marines of the murder of noncombatants in Vietnam. I don't know how many we've convicted in Iraq, but the number continues to grow. So I don't think it's broken, but it's certainly operating under severe strain.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we would not want anyone to get the impression that somehow we were saying or that anybody was arguing that that U.S. uniformed personnel are committing crimes in any large numbers. That is certainly not the case, but that we shouldn't then take the next step and say that none of them are.
Exactly right. Exactly right. We've got to remember that although there are many reports of alleged crimes that constitute war crimes, the 99.9% of our soldiers and Marines perform heroically day in and day out.
There is a legal code that the military has in place to cover soldiers, the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's U.S. military law that covers uniformed personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Then there also is, as a matter of international law, a law that governs armed conflict, although I'm not quite sure how you even think of such a thing, that there could be laws and rules that people follow when they're fighting a war. Certainly it is the case that people do things in wartime that under normal circumstances would be considered crimes. What exactly is, in a larger sense, I suppose, what is the law of war?
Well, the law of war is essentially the 1907 Hague Regulation 4, the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which are four in number, and the 1977 additional protocols to the 49 conventions, which are two in number. Now, those laws, international laws, the United States has ratified, of course, the Geneva Conventions and 1907 Hague Regulation 4. We have not ratified the additional protocols, but we are essentially bound nonetheless. There are rules on the battlefield, very definitely. There is, of course, the combatant's privilege, if privilege is the right word, that says you can kill, you can destroy without any criminal penalty as long as you are a lawful combatant. So, yes, there are rules on the battlefield. So if you were to shoot your enemy in an attack, obviously that's not an offense. On the other hand, if you were to capture your enemy after the attack and while you held him as a prisoner, put a pistol to his head and killed him, that would constitute murder. And there are laws against that, international laws, the law of armed conflict, and U.S. laws, including the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Mm-hmm. And what does the law of war say about conduct of uniformed soldiers towards civilians?
Well, that's covered under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the one regarding civilians, but that's also covered by acts in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. For example, if one were to capture or to take prisoner or to simply seize a civilian and, let's say, rape and murder her, then that individual would be charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice with the crimes of rape and murder. So we've seen that, as a matter of fact, in Vietnam. We have four individuals, the Green case, he was the leader, who raped, murdered, and burned an Iraqi family, including their 14-year-old rape victim. And three of those individuals have already been convicted, one receiving a sentence of 90 years, another receiving a sentence of 110 years. And Green, who got out of the service before he could be his crime was discovered, is to be tried in federal court where he may face the death penalty.
Hmm. So the Uniform Code of Military Justice is, in a sense, what it says it is. It's a system of law and saying you can do this, you can't do this, and also a system under which to hold people accountable, hold soldiers accountable for violations of the code.
That's correct. The code was not designed as a complement to the Geneva Conventions, but it neatly fills that role. The Geneva Conventions specify that any country that ratifies them, as every country in the world now has, is obliged to enact domestic legislation criminalizing grave breaches of that code, that is, serious breaches of the Geneva Conventions. And it is the Uniform Code of Military Justice which is the U.S. domestic legislation criminalizing violations that are committed by the armed forces. And we have other federal laws that criminalize violations committed by civilians.
Mm-hmm. And if a uniformed military personnel, a soldier, commits a crime, then he, she is subject to military law. Are they, in addition, subject to the same law that that all civilians are covered by, or do they, or by virtue of the fact that they are in the military, they are then answerable to a completely different system?
Essentially, they are subject only to military jurisdiction. There are some provisions under the War Crimes Act of 1996 that would allow for an active duty soldier to be tried, but that's very rare and unusual. It's never been done. So essentially, a soldier, a Marine, an airman, etc., who commits a crime on the battlefield is subject only to the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Mm-hmm. And do all of the rights that are given to people who are accused of crimes under the Constitution of the United States, who are civilians, does all that apply to people in the military?
Absolutely. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is not enacted by the military. It's enacted by the Congress. It is federal law. If one is convicted at a general or a special courts-martial, that individual, he or she, has a federal conviction on their record with all the attendant disabilities that that may bring. So, yes, all of the rights that you would find in any civilian court, you will find in any court-martial today, no matter where that court-martial is conducted. As a matter of fact, in some regards, it can be argued that the UCMJ is ahead of civilian criminal law, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now there seems to be a great deal of attention being paid to the conduct of private contractors. And, you know, as I noted at the beginning, there are, in fact, now more private contractors than there are soldiers in Iraq. And now a lot of those people are they're not carrying guns and they're not shooting anybody. They're providing a very wide range of services to the military, and including feeding and care of the troops and supplies and that sort of thing. However, there are people whose job it is to provide security, and there have been concerns, particularly now going back to an incident that took place in September involving people working for the firm Blackwater, some concerns about how these people are doing what they do, the use of deadly force. And so the question came, well, if people like that, if a private security contractor commits a crime, then what law applies to them? And it seemed, at least at one point, from a lot of the reporting that I was reading, the answer was, well, the Uniform Code of Military Justice doesn't apply to them because they're outside of the United States. American law doesn't apply to them. And apparently, the law of Iraq didn't apply to them. And at one point, it seemed that the answer to that question, what law applies to private contractors, the answer seemed to be there is no law that applied to them. Is that and it seems this is something now in the Congress and elsewhere we're wrestling with. What law does indeed apply to private contractors?
I'm afraid you're right. I don't think any law applies to them now. In theory, there are several laws that would apply to them, but in practice, none of them do. There is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 2, the Jurisdictional Act, has been amended as of a year ago, saying that civilians who are accompanying armed forces in the field are now subject to courts-martial. However, it's been argued that these guys are not accompanying the armed forces in the field, they're accompanying the State Department in the field. Therefore, they're outside the UCMJ's jurisdiction. There is the Extraterritorial Military MEJA, M-E-J-A, Extraterritorial Military Justice Act, which says the same thing, that anyone who commits a crime, any civilian committing a crime within a military base overseas is subject to federal jurisdiction. But once again, the phrase is inserted, if they are accompanying the armed forces in the field. The War Crimes Act of 1996, 18 U.S. Code 2441, also provides for extraterritorial jurisdiction, that is, jurisdiction over civilians outside the United States. And yet no one in 12 years has ever been tried under the War Crimes Act. Hmm. So what's left? Answer is nothing. And when the Secretary of State says there's a thoroughgoing overhaul of the rules and regulations and rules of engagement for these people, I'm entirely unimpressed. What I want to know is who's going to try them. And we don't have an answer to that.
And in fact, she just did say, I'm not sure if it was yesterday or the day before, that very thing that you just said. She said, well, the State Department is going to put into place new rules for the contractors and that more attention will be paid. However, at the same time, there certainly has been a lot of criticism of the State Department for its lack of oversight. And also, in fact, just this week on Wednesday, the official in the State Department whose job it was to oversee private contractors like Blackwater, this man, his name was Richard Griffin, he resigned. So clearly we have some problems here.
Absolutely. I suspect that Mr. Griffin was one step ahead of
of being fired?
Well, I don't know that. But yes, we absolutely do have problems. And to say that there's going to be revisions and new rules, as I say, I find unimpressive. I want to know who's going to try them, not who's going to have new rules. I want to know who has jurisdiction. And, of course, that's not an easy matter to correct. You can't simply say, well, now you have jurisdiction. There must be federal legislation to do that, and that requires the work of Congress. And, well, that requires the work of Congress.
And at one point, in some of the material that I looked at, it seemed that there was a suggestion that this question of what law applies to private contractors may depend on who is employing these contractors, in the sense that some people seem to be saying, well, a private contractor, if you were working for the Department of Defense, then you would be covered by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And the issue was for those private contractors that are being employed by the State Department, then they're not covered by the UCMJ, and they may not be covered by anything. Although, again, I think that some people have said, well, in fact, the head of Blackwater just recently said he felt that he and his people were covered by the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, and that if someone thought that they had committed a crime, that they could be brought up on charges.
Well, I suspect that Mr. Prince may know better, because the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, MEJA, also contains a provision that you must be accompanying the armed forces in the field, as opposed to the State Department in the field. So what it would require is a reworking of any new contracts to specify that they are accompanying the armed forces in the field, regardless of the fact that they may be paid by the Department of State. But whether or not that's going to happen remains to be seen, since the Department of State has been very protective of the three primary private security contractors, Blackwater, DynCorp, and Triple Canopy. So so far I have heard and seen nothing that reassures me that there are changes made that are going to have any significant effect over private security contractors who are armed in Iraq.
Well, this is something certainly that concerns members of Congress, and that legislation has, I believe, been introduced into the Senate and is at least under discussion in the House. That I guess would, well, one of the things they're talking about is saying that they're going to put all the contractors under MEJA, under the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. And although that's still something that's apparently up for discussion, is the bottom line that if the Congress considered this to be an important enough issue, that the Congress could do something about this and pass legislation that would very clearly specify what laws covered contractors, so that if contractors were accused of committing some kind of crime, that it would be very clear who they would have to answer to and how such a thing would be adjudicated.
Absolutely right, David. It's going to take an act of Congress, and it's going to take the heat from the electorate to make them continue to have the interest necessary to pass that legislation. And then, of course, we'll have to see whether or not it gets through through the administration, since the State Department has great sway, of course, in the president's office.
Just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Gary Solis. He's a scholar in residence at the Library of Congress, has recently been appointed to be the first director of West Point's Law of Armed Conflict Center. He's also adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches the law of armed conflict. Questions, comments are certainly welcome here as we're talking about the issue of the law of war, what that means both for soldiers and for private contractors. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is this particularly the issue of how these laws may or may not cover the actions by private contractors? Is this something that in the past simply wasn't an issue because we didn't have as many of them?
Correct. As you know, we had a much, much larger armed force prior to Iraq. We did have this issue in the Vietnam War. We have had civilians traveling with the military since the beginning of our nation. We've had sutlers. I mean, anybody who's watched a Western movie of John Wayne, there's always the evil sutler who's shortchanging the Indians on the reservation. Civilians who travel with the Army. They were with George Washington's Army. In Vietnam, we had a somewhat greater degree of concern. We had, for example, a murder case, United States versus Latney, where a seaman got into an argument with one of his shipmates while they were ashore at Da Nang in a bar next to the MACV headquarters, that is the Military Advisory Command Vietnam headquarters, and stabbed somebody. The Mamasan began screaming. MPs ran in to find Latney standing over the dead body with a bloody knife in his hand. Well, what to do? They didn't want to just let him return to his ship, but we didn't think we had jurisdiction over him in terms of courts-martial, but we went ahead and court-martialed him and sentenced him to, I forget how much. The conviction was overturned, and eventually the military appellate court, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, ruled that you could not try civilians under court-martial jurisdiction except in time of declared war. Well, we've seen the last of declared wars. There hasn't been a declared war since November of 1945, and we're unlikely to see another. So it's taken these new laws, MEJA, the change to the UCMJ, to give us potential court-martial jurisdiction over civilians in the combat zone. And, of course, as you say, it today, with so many, what is it, 180,000, something like that, in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's become a tremendous problem. And we have not foreseen this problem, although it's been written about for years. And now we are at a place where we must either take action, or action must be taken.
And just this is, in a sense, a side question, but I'm sure that it's something that you have thought about. Do you think that it is the case, this pattern now that we have seen with very large numbers of private contractors doing all sorts of things that soldiers, uniformed soldiers, used to do before, and as I mentioned a couple of times here, and you have mentioned the fact that in Iraq there are actually more private contractors than there are soldiers, do you think that that is going to be a fact of war and how wars will be fought in the future?
Well, I think that's a question, David, that your guess is as good as mine. My guess is that, yes, we will continue in this mode. We simply don't have the armed force necessary to conduct all of the operations and complete all the jobs and tasks on the battlefield that we used to have, so choices have to be made. And the choice we've made is to go with private contractors, and we simply have not kept pace in terms of control of these contractors as we have with the hiring of the contractors. So once we get this squared away, and it may take years, then I think the problem will abate to a certain degree. But on the other hand, I don't think the military is particularly anxious to gain jurisdiction over these individuals. I would hate to be a prosecutor of a civilian who had committed some crime when I've had no opportunity to oversee his acts or to control his acts or to discipline him prior to his coming to court-martial. It would be difficult to get witnesses. It would be difficult for a military prosecutor to get real evidence, that is, tangible evidence that he could bring into the courtroom, such as documents, records, timesheets, reports, and so forth, that were held by a civilian company who could easily lose them, and so forth. So while the military may get jurisdiction eventually, it's not an ideal case even then. But I don't think there is an ideal jurisdictional answer.
Well, that's my very thought was that, yes, and if the military would have those kinds of difficulties in the prosecution of a private contractor, then I would imagine that whoever it was that was carrying on the prosecution would have the same difficulties.
Not only the same difficulty, but if it were a federal prosecutor, an even greater difficulty. We're seeing these problems in, for example, the Haditha case and the Hamdaniya cases, courts-martial at Camp Pendleton, California, that are being conducted for crimes that occurred 6,000 miles away in Iraq. If a federal prosecutor were attempting to try a civilian contractor for an event that occurred in Iraq, you can imagine the difficulties, the practical difficulties that prosecutor would have trying to, for example, obtain witness statements from Iraqis. Well, it couldn't be done. They don't want to cooperate when you're standing in front of them, let alone when you're sending them a message 6,000 miles away. You couldn't get a look at the crime scene itself. You would have all of your tangible evidence it's very evanescent evidence. That is, it disappears very quickly. I mean, blood stains, shell casings on the floor, and so forth. If you don't get them when the crime occurs, you're not going to get them at all. So prosecuting a case that has occurred thousands of miles away with uncooperative witnesses who won't provide permission to exhume bodies to determine cause of death, there are the problems for a prosecutor are numerous. And I think that's why we've not seen any prosecutions under the War Crimes Act, for example. Why would a federal prosecutor want to prosecute a crime that happened a continent away when he's got all the crime he can handle that happened outside his front door?
Mm-hmm. We have several callers here. We'd like to bring him into the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here we're moving into the second half of the show. We'll start in with someone in Champaign County, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. bit of a digression first, evoking John Wayne's movies, American Mythology. You have to remind yourself that he was actually a World War II draft dodger. But putting that aside, American military at the site of the Blackwater shooting within a half hour, and the evidence they gathered was chronicled in the Washington Post. So there's, and it was very much against Blackwater. There were no shells except a Blackwater issue there, and all, there were no. Anyway, it was open and shut from the point of view of the military that were just there. These were maybe military people that didn't want to keep their job prospects open for going to Blackwater afterward, which I heard was actually cited as a reason why they don't want to bother with it. But you mentioned Haditha. Haditha is a disgrace of America, of military justice. So I actually don't see it as a solution. There's this idea of you just glibly saying that 99.9% of soldiers are not committing any kind of infraction of any sort in Iraq is belies imagination. It seems to me we have evidence of so many relatively youthful Iraqi men dying from heart attacks in incarceration. There's a lot of evidence that there's a lot going on that we don't want to look at, and I think evading the unpleasant possibility that there could be as much of that going on as there is just evading the issue, it seems to me.
Well, first let me respond in regard to John Wayne. John Wayne was not eligible for the draft. He was 4F because of a football injury he'd received at USC rather than actually evading the draft. But in regard to your comments on American soldiers and Marines in Iraq, I would disagree. I think it's an unfair assessment to say that to suggest that there is wholesale war crimes or violations of the law that are occurring over there. And you say that Haditha is a blot on America's reputation, with which I would certainly agree. But I would suggest that Haditha and its predecessor Hamdaniya and these other prosecutions that we see are evidence of the fact that we are doing our best to prosecute war crimes. I think.
How could it be both the best and a blot?
Well, obviously, the fact that there are 24 individuals, non-combatant individuals, who died is an obvious blot on the reputation, on the conduct of American soldiers, on the reputation of America. I'm sure you would agree that that is a blot. On the other hand,
I'm talking about the trial being the blot. No higher-ranking officials have been sacked or even punished in any way.
Well, actually, Major General Richard Huck has received a letter of censure from the Secretary of Navy. Colonel Gary Sokolowski, his chief of staff, has received a letter. Colonel Stephen Davis, his staff judge advocate, have received a letter. These are individuals who have spent their lives honorably defending America in far-flung shores, and their careers are over, ended ignominiously by these letters of reprimand. Yet, so there have been seniors that have been censured. And, of course, we're going to see Lieutenant Colonel Chassani, the battalion commander of the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, a unit that was engaged in Haditha, is going to be court-martialed. There is a platoon commander who we don't know yet if the recommendation will be for court-martial or not. But my point is, the Marine Corps has taken very seriously this event, and I think I would agree with you that the court-martial represents the continuation of the blot on America's reputation. But do we not have to give some credit to the Marine Corps? They found out, when they finally found out about it, when higher headquarters finally found out about it, they took action. Now look at the wide net that was thrown in Haditha. They charged the battalion commander, the legal officer, the company commander, the platoon commander. Now, through a series of investigations, and there were four investigations, including one by Naval Criminal Investigative Service, it was 3,700 pages long, another by a two-star Army general, another by a one-star Army general. These investigations, it seems to me, indicate the military's seriousness in pursuing charged criminality. Now, and I would agree with you that Abu Ghraib is is the opposite of this, where nobody of a higher grade has been punished. We had a brigadier general who was reduced to colonel. As far as I'm concerned, that was insufficient. The colonel who was in charge was not court-martialed. He was given immunity. As far as I'm concerned, that was in itself wrong. So I would certainly agree that we have not done a good job in some cases, and I would certainly agree that there are far too many murders, assaults, rapes that go on in Iraq. But, heck, we've got to give some credit to these kids who are out there, the bulk of them operating under what I would consider heroic circumstances. I mean, these are guys, kids 19, 20, 21 years old, 130-degree heat, humping 80-pound packs day after day, patrol after patrol. And I'm not willing to tar them with the same brush.
I got to get on some other callers. Just to stay just for a second, though, with Haditha, do you think that eventually the soldiers that have been accused of the actual crimes, the actual killings, that if indeed they are judged to be guilty, that they will be held accountable?
That remains to be seen. That's something that's bothered me. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article on that to that very effect in the Naval Institute Proceedings last year, that we're having too few convictions, and when there are convictions, the sentences are not commensurate with the seriousness of the crimes that the individuals have been convicted of. So what's going to happen? Well, I say if it goes to trial, then it's in the hands of the jury, and I can't second-guess a jury, be it a civilian or a military jury. If the jury comes back and sentences him to life, well, that's a sentence of the military community, the jury that's been to Iraq, and their judgment. If they sentence him to 90 days, well, I have to accept that as well. And is that sufficient? It depends on your point of view, I guess.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, I have enjoyed this listening about the deficiencies of the military justice system. I was a former JAG, so I know about the difficulties of that. But I want to get back to the government contractors and criminal jurisdiction over them. I believe the individual who was head of Blackwater came and testified before a couple of congressional committees, maybe one headed by Congressman Waxman, and it came out that this guy had been a significant contributor, political contributor to, I believe, the Bush-Cheney administration and their campaigns. And I'm not mistaken, there seems to be a great reluctance at the outset to agree that maybe some jurisdiction should be put over these guys out of the White House. And I'm wondering if the White House really does not want any accountability criminally for the acts of people like Blackwater and the other government contractors, and if the policy behind this could be simply a political one.
Well, politics is beyond my ken, but it would not shock me to hear that that's true. Blackwater has received more than $1 billion in contracts in the last 5 years, and not only is Mr. Prince a heavy contributor to many politicians, including a few Democrats, but his sister-in-law, of course, is the chairman of the Republican Committee of the state of Michigan, wherever her home state is, and her husband was the Republican governor nominee or candidate, that is. So there could be politics involved, but this is something that obviously now has to go beyond politics. But are there politics involved? Could be.
Are you asking me?
No, I think I just
believe every time the Bush-Cheney administration does something, irrespective of the ultimate outcome, that politics trumps accountability. And I think that's happened time and time again in the prosecution of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And I just really believe in some way underlying this is not good politics when it comes to government contractors like Blackwater. But that's just my opinion. I was trying to elicit the opinion of someone who had greater expertise about this than I, because I think what the State Department and the Bush administration, White House, is doing or wants to do here with respect to rules and regulations without concrete things about charges, jurisdiction, and whether they will be prosecuted is just lip service to things that they always give lip service to. So that's just my opinion. Thank you for your time, sir.
Sure. Well, so far I would certainly agree that what we're hearing is lip service without any action, and I'm surprised that a democratically controlled Congress isn't more aggressive in making changes here. But so far there's been no action of any tangible sort that would change the status quo.
Just very quickly, before I go to the next caller, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Gary Solis. He is a 2006-2007 scholar in residence at the Library of Congress, was recently appointed first director of West Point's Law of Armed Conflict Center. He's also adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches the law of armed conflict. He's a retired U.S. Marine with 26 years active duty, including tours in Vietnam. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Geneva. This is line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I kind of hate the way this whole thing is going as far as people calling in. It's like they want to dump on the average soldier now. I mean, I don't know if you're getting that, but there are problems over there. I've got two good friends of mine that are over there, and I got to tell you that 100% of the media that's out there is always it's biased. It's basically brought back. They're not telling the whole story, and I kind of hate the way this is going, because the two previous callers are a good example. They're basically telling the average soldier they're garbage. The guy that was two callers before you basically said that everybody that's an American soldier is a pig, is a killer, and they ought not to be there. And I've heard this over and over, not only on this station, on other stations. Don't get me wrong. I just think the American's point of view on the average soldier is so twisted and so warped, it's ridiculous. It would make me want to, if I was a military person, it would make me want to throw up, you know?
Well,
your guest is bringing some really good stuff out there. Now, and I know that having grown up in the military family for years, I could tell you a lot of the information that's out there is a lot of misinformation. Now, is Dick Cheney and George Bush responsible? We won't ever know until probably after they're gone, or maybe for that matter. You know, it might be like 50 years or 100 years down the road before we really actually know the truth about any of this stuff. Because we all know how the propaganda machine works out there. I just had to call in and say, look, the average soldier go out there are being shot at every day. From what my friend tells me, because he's gone back for his third rotation, is that a lot of the people during the daytime are your friends. At night, they turn around and they sniper at you. All right? That's what the kind of stuff we ought to contend with over there. There's a lot of innocent Iraqis that get, you know, mistakenly picked up, you know. And sure, there's no law over there. People have to remember it's the Middle East. You know, even if we weren't there, you got to look at the history behind the whole Middle East in the first place. Nobody ever does that. Is Blackwater involved in a lot of stuff? You know, without a doubt, I'm pretty sure that a lot of this is bought and paid for. As your guest is kind of saying, there's a lot of information he probably can't get because of all this. And again, it relates back to we probably won't find out until, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney are out of office. But any president sitting in the office, there's a lot of misinformation. You know, I could go back to Clinton in the days where he went and bombed. That one day he went and bombed, the Syrian lab or the milk factory. I mean, I could go back to previous administrations and say the same thing. You know, the facts are what they are, and this guy's trying to bring out as much as he can. And I appreciate that.
What I don't appreciate
is the kind of bad-mouthing of the soldier.
Okay.
I'll get off. Thank you.
I don't know. Professor Solis, you can react to any of that in any way you like.
You bet. I think that that your caller's point is well taken, that we need to separate the political aspect of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq from the conduct of the soldiers. When soldiers commit crimes that are discovered, we prosecute those crimes, and that's a right thing to do. But we should not close our eyes to the fact that most of our soldiers over there, particularly not particularly reservists, but including reservists, are conducting themselves not only honorably but heroically under the most, you know, insurgent warfare is the worst kind of warfare possible. It's a warfare where every object, every car, every person can be the means of your death, and you never know it until it's almost too late. This is a terribly difficult kind of war to fight, and we're sending over young men and women to do it, and we need to remember that these guys, you know, the war hardly touches most of America, but these guys are touched in a big way, and we should take our hats off to these gents and these ladies. And at the same time, if they commit a crime, then there's a price to be paid.
Hmm. If you or I went to another country and committed a crime, I think that it would be clear that we would be subject to the laws of that country.
Hmm.
How is it that I suppose one could make a particular case for uniform personnel who happened to be stationed in another country, whether there was war going on there or not, for being subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice and not the law of that country. But how, and particularly in a case like this, again, like in the case of Iraq, how is it that it is not clear that civilian contractors wouldn't be subject to the laws of Iraq? I mean, why is it that the government of Iraq can't pick up the if there are allegations that a military contractor committed a crime, why is it that the government of Iraq can't arrest the person and put him on trial?
Right, a little Alice in Wonderland logic here. The Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, when Bremer was in charge of the country, passed a variety of laws. And one of those laws, CPA Law 17, says that no American, including contractors, will be subject to Iraqi law. And when Iraq gained sovereignty, regained sovereignty, I think it was 28 June 2004, there was another law passed, CPA 100, saying that these previous laws, including CPA 17, would carry on. Mm-hmm. So when Iraq regained sovereignty, when its government stood up, it stood up with some baggage. And part of that baggage was CPA Law 17 saying that civilian contractors would not be subject to Iraqi jurisdiction. So it's clear under Iraqi law, although that law was essentially imposed by the United States, Iraqi law precludes jurisdiction, and that's how it came about. Now, whether or not that's whether that makes it right or makes sense, I'll leave it to you.
Well, and in those cases where, say, we have a American military personnel stationed in another country outside of the United States, and it's not a place where there's a war going on,
mm-hmm.
And that individual is charged with a crime, how is it that then that person doesn't end up getting tried by the local authorities?
Well, in every country where U.S. troops are stationed during peacetime, there is what they call a Status of Forces Agreement, a SOFA. Mm-hmm. And the SOFA sets out the rules and the agreement between the host state and the sending state as to a variety of things, including criminal jurisdiction. And the United States is always very leery of giving up jurisdiction over its men and women, its armed forces members in a foreign country. Sometimes the judicial system of those countries may be suspect. Sometimes we simply don't want to do it for whatever reason. However, some SOFAs do provide for criminal jurisdiction in the host country. For example, I did three tours on Okinawa, and on Okinawa, the Japanese have jurisdiction over any criminality committed by armed forces members off base.
Mm-hmm.
And drug offenses committed anywhere on the island. So it depends on the Status of Forces Agreement. Sometimes you do have U.S. soldiers, Marines, airmen subject to local jurisdiction. And we have a number of Marines and sailors who have been tried by the Japanese and who are in Japanese prisons as a result of the terms of the SOFA that we have with Japan.
Well, just to come around here to, again, some of the basic questions, I guess at least here now recently, the big focus has been on the private contractors and what, if any, laws apply to them. And we've talked about the fact that The State Department, the Secretary of State, Secretary of State Rice, has said that they will put into place new rules for the contractors, and that there will be greater oversight. And within Congress, there are movements to make it very clear that there are rules that cover the contractors and to specify just what rules they are. So it's something that's being talked about, and it's being talked about now because it's so much attention has been focused on particularly Blackwater and this incident that took place in mid-September. But I'm sure that there are other cases that one could point to that would suggest the need to make this very, very clear. I suppose that the question is, do you think that that this is going to result in some action? Or is it just something that we're going to be talking about and the State Department will say, yes, we think this is important and we'll get on this and then we'll go on to something else?
Well, it's really hard to tell, David. I think that talk is cheap and I'm cynical. I think political talk is worthless. But there may be enough interest, enough heat from not only the American electorate but the international community and the Iraqi community to force the hand of Congress and for Congress to say, all right, henceforth, all contracts will say that the individual private security contractors are accompanying the armed forces in the field, making them subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. While it may be uncomfortable for military prosecutors, and while it may be difficult for military prosecutors, they are in country, they are in place, they know how to prosecute cases, and that might provide some basis for the prosecution of private security contractors who are armed. Hmm. So, yes, I think it is possible that Congress would act in this case because of the continuing high level of interest in making something happen.
Well, just let me to make sure that I understand, and I don't know if this is splitting hairs here, but maybe that's what law is really all about. If you you use a phrase like the private contractors are accompanying uniformed military, and so should be governed by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, just like uniformed soldiers are. When you use that phrase, does that mean that a uniformed American soldier has to be standing right next to them, or does that mean that because they're both in the same country that they are working together?
Actually, I think, David, it means a little of both and a little of neither. There's a lawyer's answer. What accompanying the armed forces in the field is simply a legal term of art. It is a magic wand. You put that phrase in the contract, and that means you're subject to military justice. And that's all it is. So you don't look to see if the individual is actually on a military base, if the individual is actually working for the Department of State. You simply have it in his contract that he is accompanying the armed forces in the field, and that is sufficient to give military jurisdiction.
So essentially, if they're both in the same theater of war,
right?
That's what really we mean. Not necessarily that somehow they're working hand in hand,
exactly,
or that they're working together on the same mission, or that they're sitting in the same Humvee, or anything like that.
Exactly. As you can imagine, it would be an impossible task to examine every case to ensure that they were actually sitting next to somebody in a Humvee or otherwise working physically closely with a military individual. So you merely put that in their contract, and that would be sufficient. Now, as we've been saying all along, we're going to see if the State Department is going to go along with that, and then if the administration, i.e. President Bush, goes along with that. Because up to now, the State Department has been very protective of Blackwater individuals. We've read about the Blackwater individual who, on Christmas Eve last year, while drunk, shot and killed a bodyguard of a high political appointee, Iraqi appointee, mm-hmm. and the State Department hustled him out of country within 24 hours and paid off the family of the victim so nothing more would be said about it. So will the State Department change its viewpoint? Again, one can be hopeful that there's enough political interest and heat to make that happen.
Do you have, I wonder, in whatever conversations you may have with military people, particularly active duty military people, do they have feelings, strong feelings that they're willing to voice, off the record maybe, but they're willing to voice about private contractors and how they conduct themselves and what sort of rules apply to that conduct?
Absolutely, and on the record, they're willing to voice them, and they are not happy with private contractors. I was down at the Marine Corps University last month talking with some commanders who are going back to Iraq, and their problem is that the contractors, since they're not under the authority of the military, feel no obligation to inform the military that they are, for example, conducting air operations through our TAOR, Tactical Area of Responsibility. So you have a military air controller, and suddenly you've got three Blackwater helicopters shooting through there where they've got an air operation on going on. And they've never been advised that this is going to happen. They have to call off the military aircraft. The same thing happens with convoys. They never know when these guys are going to be there. When you have armed people going through your area, you want to know about it. And there is no obligation on Blackwater, DynCorp, Triple Canopy to notify the military. And that exercises the military greatly. You're trying to conduct operations to win the hearts and minds of the people over there. And how? So what Blackwater did in that roundabout in September is 180 degrees out from what the military is trying to do. It sets back the U.S. effort in Iraq months, if not years. And the Iraqi civilian, understandably, doesn't say, well, this was a private civilian contractor. He says it was Americans. And so the military has to pay the price. That's the kind of event that recruits new insurgents. And the military has to pay the price in blood.
Well, there we'll have to leave it with thanks to our guest, Gary Solis. He's scholar in residence at the Library of Congress, recently appointed as first director of West Point's Law of Armed Conflict Center. He's also adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches the law of armed conflict. Professor Solis, thank you very much.
My pleasure.